Thing one, uncertainty. We might be getting more of that. Thing two, economic growth. Do we have too much of that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 24th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Things were unsettled in a certain part of this economy today. The political part is what I'm talking about, with the tide turning toward impeachment. And one imagines the already high level of economic uncertainty only increasing in the months to come. But there are some in this economy who are completely certain that this is a good time to sell. Corporate insiders, which is to say board members and C-suite executives, are selling shares of their own companies at the fastest rate since 2000, back in the dot-com bubble days. That's according to some analysis first reported by the Financial Times, and we ought to say. And you're probably thinking right now, well, what do those people sell and know that the rest of us don't? Good question. Marketplace's Justin Ho went in search of the answer.
Investors like it when corporate insiders own stock in the companies they run, says Karen Kavanaugh at Voya Investment Management.
They want to make sure that the company executives have some skin in the game.
There are plenty of reasons executives might sell some of their stock. It could be to buy a car, to pay their kids' college tuition. Hillary Kramer of Kramer Capital Research says they could also be doing some estate planning.
You know, passing money on to their children, making sure that they're diversified in terms of planning. It's just a fancy way to say, how are you going to leave money to the next generation?
But when a lot of executives start selling at the same time, like they are now, Kramer says markets start paying attention because
it may very well be just a reflection of what executives believe the actual overall economy will do, and that a downturn may happen in the very near future.
Corporate insiders might also be thinking about the political future. NYU finance professor David Yermak says they may be selling because taxes on capital gains could increase after 2020.
And so selling shares of stock will be much more expensive if the Democrats win the presidential election, reverse some of the Trump tax cuts, and maybe put in some new taxes on the very wealthy.
Yermak says after Obama won the 2012 election, companies paid out more in dividends before the Bush tax cuts expired the following year. And insider selling picked up back then as well. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Even though we're all living in it every day, the nuts and bolts of this economy can be tough to grasp. What matters and why? So, to help you understand things maybe a little bit better, cue the latest installment of our new series. Again, I didn't pick this name. Kai Explains.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
Today on the Kai Explains agenda, household debt. First of all, there's a lot of it. According to the New York Fed, $13.8 trillion in the year 2019, slightly more than before the financial crisis. Second of all, it's not necessarily great when household debt gets that high. Economist Melanie Long teaches at the College of Worcester.
Households that have high levels of debt and that are already perhaps struggling to pay that debt back may no longer be able to meet those repayment obligations in the case of those unexpected expenses.
Maybe we define some terms here, huh?
So the largest component of household debt is mortgage debt.
More than $9 trillion on mortgages.
We also have student loan debt and automobile debt.
About $17 billion in car loans, almost $1.5 trillion in student debt.
Followed by other things like credit card debt or medical debt.
So, how exactly did we get here? Well, the job market's been pretty strong. Consumers have been feeling pretty good. But
more generally, debt continues to serve as a safety net for households,
which is not great. Also, when consumers pay down debt, that is income not being spent on other stuff. And as we say all the time on this program,
consumers certainly matter a lot. Consumer spending, by my way of thinking, is at least 70% of the economy.
Stephen Fazzari there. He's a professor of economics at Washington University in St. Louis.
The consumer debt situation right now is manageable.
Yeah, manageable overall. You break it down a little bit, though?
I would be more concerned, for example, about rising student loans. It slows the ability of younger households in particular to buy new homes.
And then you roll in all the other consumer habits that really drive things.
If things start to slow down in other parts of the economy, that's going to slow the growth of incomes. And we'll probably see a fall of consumer confidence and some decline in consumer spending.
And as it happens, the consumer confidence number came out today, the lowest it's been since the beginning of the year. Let us know what you want me to explain next. We've already got, by the way, consumer confidence and consumer sentiment in the hopper. You can tell us, though, what you want to hear at marketplace.org, or you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Kai Ryssdal, KAIRYSSDAL. They told me I had to spell it, so I am. Traders and the algorithms they love weren't wild about the impeachment news today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. At the end of the program yesterday, we played you part of the speech that Greta Thunberg had given at the United Nations, the relevant part of which for us was this.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
A couple hours later, I got a tweet from a guy by the name of Rob Reich. He's a professor of political science at Stanford, and he said, and this is the quote, "Hey, Kai, that Greta Thunberg clip you just played on Marketplace, she was talking also to you and your show. Would be nice to hear your reply." So first of all, Professor Reich, thanks for listening. Second of all, maybe it would be better to hear from an actual economist about economic growth. Ashok Modi is a professor of international economic policy at Princeton, the Woodrow Wilson School there. Thanks for coming on the program, sir.
Thank you very much.
First of all, did you hear or see what Greta Thunberg said yesterday?
Yes, I did.
And what was
your... Very important statement.
Yeah, what was your gut reaction?
Look, I'm very inspired by her, and I think she is cutting out a path, a political path, on which economists must now travel.
This is going to sound like a very fundamental question, but why does growth... economic growth matter?
It matters because we want people's lives to be better. Where we've gone wrong is not in pursuing growth, but in pursuing the wrong kind of growth. And I think it must be the case, it had better be the case, that we can do a kind of growth that ultimately helps people's lives and makes the climate change problem less daunting than it is.
How important is it that not all growth is created equal? It's one thing for a developing economy to grow very quickly now because they have the means and they want to raise their standards of living. It's another thing for some place like the United States to grow at an equivalent rate, and it's a different ballgame.
That is correct. And so the United States will clearly not grow at the same rate as India will. Nevertheless, even slow growth in the United States is A, important for the U.S. itself. Remember, yes, the U.S. is a rich country, but there are lots of people leading very precarious lives. But there is also a more basic reason, even from a developing emerging country point of view, that relatively slow growth in the United States nevertheless feeds into world trade, which then makes other countries prosper as they participate in global trade. There's no question that all of these need growth in any kind of horizon, both short-term and long-term.
Economic growth and actual substantive action on climate change, is that possible for them to work together, or are they mutually exclusive?
Yes. No, and I think they need to work together. Responding to that directly, I think the Green New Deal, or just the philosophy of Green New Deal, is essentially the right one. And what is that saying? That is saying that we need to change the way we do things. It requires a much more intrusive environmental regulation on the premise that that regulation will create a new avenue for innovation and investment. And that new avenue for innovation and investment will create a different kind of growth, a growth that helps people come out of poverty, helps people repay their debts. And we need growth for that, but in a way in which we keep our air clean, we clean our water. I think that that is the direction I'm reading from her comments.
Ashok Modi is a professor of international economic policy at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. His most recent book is called Euro Tragedy, a drama in 9 acts. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
There's news of the labor force today, specifically those who work more than 40 hours a week. The Labor Department has expanded the pool of people who are eligible for time and a half, raising the federal threshold for overtime pay to include people making about $35,000 a year or less. That's a bump from an OT threshold of about $24,000. And the Trump administration says it's going to make an extra 1.3 million more people eligible for overtime. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, could have been a lot more people.
Starting January 1st, newly eligible workers could get time and a half for overtime, or their employers could just give them a raise to bring them past the new threshold. Trey Kovacs is a policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
A lot of those workers will be in the retail industry, in a lot of the rural communities around the United States where cost of living is low and wages are lower.
The Trump administration's new rule is being cheered by many business groups. Mark Friedman is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Well, we think it's a very sensible and balanced update to a threshold that has not been updated since 2004, so 15 years.
But worker advocates say this move does far less than an Obama administration overtime rule, which was overturned by a Texas court in 2016. Heidi Shearholtz at the Economic Policy Institute helped develop that rule.
Less than half of the workers who would have gotten protections under the 2016 rule will be getting protections under the rule that was published today.
Shearholtz says this new version leaves behind many workers who may be classified as managers but still making low wages.
So think of frontline supervisors of retail workers. So they're low-level managers who are being asked to work a lot of hours for free.
Another change, unlike the Obama version, this rule doesn't boost the overtime threshold automatically, leaving it up to future administrations to adjust the limit on their own. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
From the healthcare just ain't what it used to be file, this item. Now, Walmart is trying to persuade more of its employees to get health-related bachelor's degrees and certificates as part of a company benefit that lets those workers take college classes for $1 a day. The company is hoping that'll help it fill jobs in its own growing healthcare business and industry that, as you know, more retailers are expanding into. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Walmart's big expansion into healthcare started about 5 years ago with the addition of in-store care clinics staffed with nurse practitioners. Customers can pop in to be seen for a sore ankle and knock out some shopping.
Every dollar customers are spending on medical costs is a dollar that they can't spend in stores.
Jeff Becker covers the healthcare industry at Forrester.
Walmart sees itself as financially incentivized to bring the cost of care down for its customers. And then it also sees a necessity to bring down the medical costs that it is paying for its employee health expenses.
Becker says the more Walmart employees take advantage of the clinics, the lower the healthcare costs for the company. And nearly 1.5 million people work at Walmart. Spokesperson Michelle Malashok says as Walmart becomes a bigger player in healthcare, it's got more jobs to fill.
Getting the right workforce in place, especially at Walmart's scale, we definitely need expertly trained associates to do that.
Other big retailers are moving aggressively into retail clinics, too. CVS is turning 1,500 locations into health hubs, offering things like cholesterol screenings and physicals. There's also a growing number of clinics inside Targets and Walgreens. Vivian Ho is a healthcare economist at Rice University.
With 18% of gross domestic product going towards healthcare, this is a way for them to get a piece of that slice.
Walmart's now trying to appeal to those customers who might prefer to go to a standalone clinic. This month, the company opened a 10,000-square-foot Walmart Health Center outside of Atlanta. It'll offer even more services like dentistry and mental health care. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I had a really steep learning curve of figuring out how to play the game.
The things we don't talk about when we talk about making it in this economy. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 142 points, about a half percent, 26,807. The NASDAQ gave back 118 points, 1.4%, 79.93. The S&P 500 dropped 25 points, about 0.8%, 29.66 there. Shares of Netflix down 4.2% today after a couple of Wall Street analysts expressed some doubts about the company's outlook and its upcoming quarterly results. Competition with the likes of Disney and Apple as well. Disney down 0.3%. Apple retreated 0.4% today. Speaking of Apple, an analyst from Jefferies upgraded the company, but not because of the fancy iPhone 11s. No, the analyst said Apple is going to do great with the not-yet-released 5G phones. Sometime down the line, bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.64%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace helps you stay sharp on all things related to business and the economy. And to help you do some numbers of your own, you can get your very own Marketplace pencil pack when you become a Marketplace investor today. It's a set of six pencils, each stamped with a different Marketplace quote, yours for a donation of just $5 a month. So please support public service journalism and get your pencil pack today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is going to sound a little metaphysical, but it seems the right to be forgotten only extends as far as the borders of the European Union. So said the European Court of Justice today, interpreting the EU's relatively strict, at least as compared to ours, internet consumer privacy laws. Molly Wood is who we call when there are stories like these. She is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So make me smart on this one. Why does it matter?
Well, it matters in a couple of ways. One is that this move is an attempt to correct some of the issues with the original right to be forgotten, specifically that it got a little broader as it was implemented since about 2014. It could be abused to try to get Google and search engines to take down news articles that might be critical of someone, for example. So it tries to create a more specific framework for what types of content qualify for this forgettable status. But more importantly, which is, I think, something we can all aspire to, right?
Right.
But more importantly, it restricts the existing right to be forgotten just to Europe and the European Union. That's the big headline here.
Okay, so look, if I'm a person who goes into and out of the European Union, or I do business over there or whatever, what does it mean for me as a consumer and a user of the internet?
I mean, that's the part that we sort of have to remain to be seen. If you are a citizen of Europe and you go to Google and you say, you know, I meet the new criteria for you to take down this information, please remove these search results, then, and Google decides to do it, then those results will presumably be scrubbed from showing up in the European Union, but they might still show up in other parts of the world. So if back in America, you, Kai Rizdahl, do that same Google search, you may find the same information. So it makes things a little more complicated, but Google still considered it a win.
So first of all, never Google yourself, right? That's rule number one. Rule number two, though, is does the internet work this way? Can you have like sections of it partitioned off?
That is, I think, what we are about to find out. And this is really one of those moves that only continues this trend of balkanization of the internet, where you really have a very different, we've talked about this a lot, but you have a very different set of rules of the road in Europe another set in the United States, a totally different set in China or other countries. And it certainly makes it more complicated for companies that are doing business across national lines. Even though Google sees this as a victory, I would imagine it would just be easier to like scrub a result from everything.
Tell me more about Google seeing this as a victory, because I don't think I totally understand that part.
I think Google did not want to have to offer. Google doesn't, anything that limits the scope of right to be forgotten is ultimately a victory for Google. It says, you know, Google, the platform, is not necessarily responsible. It puts more of the onus back on the consumer to sort of manage our own reputations or the information about us online. It bolsters companies that allow you to pay to manage your reputation and your information online, and it takes them a little more out of the equation.
Super quick. It's still incumbent upon consumers, users of the internet, to initiate this forget-me action, right?
It is, and it always has been. And in fact, it's not necessarily a bad thing, I think, to have consumers in charge of deciding what to delete and not to delete, as opposed to Google. That's been one criticism of this rule.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Part of the conversation around higher education in this country is financial, of course, how much college costs, how a degree can change your long-term earning prospects. But there is an emotional reality, too, especially if you're the first person in your family to go to college. That's the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Heather Cantua Phillips, and I live in Alameda, California, and I'm a lawyer. I grew up in Livermore, California, as an only child to two parents who were high school graduates. Going to college was a goal that my mom always had for me. Once I got to college, I had a really steep learning curve of figuring out how to play the game. You know, there are a lot of unwritten rules as to how you can act in college, you know, when you approach a professor, what classes to take, how to prioritize things. And I sort of had to figure it out on my own. Financially, my income is now substantially more than both of my parents had ever made combined. From a cash flow perspective, I feel much more financially secure than my parents. But on the flip side, I also feel less stable than my parents did. I think my parents have hope for the future, even though they have experienced setbacks. They have built up a lot of equity in their house. They are now both happily recently retired. I do think that I have anxiety about the economy that my parents don't. First of all, it's just much more expensive to live. So even with the increase in income, it doesn't feel like I'm that much richer than my parents were. Combine that with, you know, my parents never had any college or professional school debt to pay off. So again, even though I'm making more money, I'm spending more money. I don't talk about finances much with my parents. I think one part of upward mobility that might get overlooked, or at least that I didn't understand before, is that there's a trade-off with that. And part of the trade-off is losing some of the deep relationships with your family that maybe you would have otherwise. My parents don't have the ability to really relate to me when it comes to my profession, and I can feel it and they can feel it. And so they mostly trust that I'm just taking care of myself, and I trust that they're taking care of themselves.
Heather Phillips in Alameda, California. Can't do any of this without you, right? The stories of your economy are what we need. Send them to us at marketplace.org. The This final note on the way out today, in which this caveat applies, past performance is no indicator of future results. With impeachment now on the agenda in Washington, this look back at the most recent example, summer of 1998 and Bill Clinton. In the lead up to the release of the Starr Report, the S&P 500 lost almost 20% of its value. But from the start of impeachment proceedings in the House in October of 98 till Clinton was acquitted by the Senate in February of 99, S&P 500 was up 28%. Consult your own financial and perhaps political advisor, of course. All right, we are going. The Dow off 142 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ gave back 118, that is 1.4%. The S&P 500 dropped 25 points, about 0.8% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.